Welcome everybody to SF Live. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Zohr Financial Group. Thank you for joining us. We got an extra special episode lined up again with you for you today, and we'll be joined in a few short seconds by Andy Schechtman. He's the CEO of Miles Franklin, and somebody been wanting to bring on the program for a while now because he's the CEO of a bullion dealer. He sees exactly what is happening behind the curtain, and you know, we can help we can start looking behind the headlines with him as well. How real is a silver squeeze? How real is the Fed sort of crushing the silver price as well? Like, what's involved there, and why are the premiums so high for some things? Really curious to hear his perspective. Before I switch over to my guest, make sure to follow us on YouTube, follow us on Twitter, hit that like and subscribe button. It tremendously helps us out with the algorithm, and we can't wait to have you comment as well and sort of hear your opinion on that. We'll definitely get back to that. Now, I've said enough. Let me switch over to my guest. And Andy, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here, Kai. Thanks for having me, bud. Good to see you again.
Yeah, it's been a while since we last chatted. We were on a panel together, together with Rob Keynes and a couple other guys. Jesus, a long time ago. It's just, time has just flown by. How you been, and how busy are you these days, Andy?
That's funny you say that, because I think the last couple of years, Kai, have blended together, melded together in a way that, I don't know, I find it difficult to keep track of the passage of time, it seems, where days seem to blur and weeks seem to blur. And I don't know, it's all, ever since 2020, life has just been upside down. So it's been great. It's been, I guess you could say, unlike anything I've ever experienced in 33 years of business. The last 3 years, 2.5 years have ushered in, I think, kind of a renaissance or an awakening, if you will, in alternative assets. And we've seen a larger groundswell of people who are interested now for the first time ever in precious metals. And with that has come I would say 4, 5, 6x of anything that we've ever done before. So crazy to say the least. Certainly don't feel sorry for me. I feel blessed, but it's been a whirlwind, to say the least.
I can imagine. And silver price in particular it's been somewhat volatile as well. Never seen that in my personal opinion. It felt like we dipped down to $18. Now we're back up at $19.40. Sort of countercyclical, like trending versus against gold. Like, gold is going down and silver's been going up. I haven't really seen that together before. How is that happening? Like, how does that fit in with the physical world as well?
Well, you know, the physical world I've said for a very long time, Kai, and I get a lot of heat for it. Maybe I don't do a good enough job in explaining myself, if you will. I believe in my soul that this market ultimately will be defined by an inability to readily source product. It used to be my biggest problem was finding clients, not finding product. And now it's inverted. Finding clients is fortunately not as difficult as finding product and keeping it in. I received an email just yesterday from one of the largest distributors in the world. And in looking at what they were offering, honest to God, almost every single silver item that they had said sold out, or if it wasn't, it was limited and or delayed. And gold, not so much. I think ultimately that will happen with gold. But the reason I say it will define the marketplace, number one, you know, it's been very difficult to get stuff, and it's getting difficult. But this is with, as Rick Rule, my friend, often talks about, a 0.5% allocation to precious metals. And you know, throughout the entire financial matrix, from Joe Sixpack on the street to the Harvard Endowment Fund. And so when you're talking about just how difficult it is to get precious metals right now, that's with 0.5%. Now, if you go back to 1980, we had an 8% allocation to precious metals. And by extrapolation, if you pick the mean or the average of the last 40 years, that's 2.5%. In other words, anyone who has metals on average would have 2.5% of their assets, of their investable assets, in precious metals. Well, that would represent a fivefold increase in demand in this industry that it certainly cannot handle. So I think that in general, let me shut off this beeping here, sorry. So in general, the supply has been okay, but it's getting harder and harder and harder. And part of the reason that is that, you know, you have an awakening to inflation and geopolitical issues globally. Europe is a basket case, worse than we are here. Most of the mints, four of the six primary mints, are across the pond. You got the United Kingdom, Australia, South Africa, and Austria. And so all of these countries are experiencing inflation. All of these countries are not immune to geopolitical issues and strife. And so you have a global demand source or base that is competing for product. And, you know, in the years that I've been doing this, in the 33 years I've been doing this, a lot of the time I've been doing this, dollar assets were king. Stocks, bonds, real estate, everything was hunky-dory. There was no reason to worry about protecting your purchasing power. And so, you know, we didn't have to compete with most of the world for product. I would have distributors that would call me and say, listen, let me source or stage, they would say, how about 50,000 silver kangaroos? I'll put them in your vault. I'd say, listen, I don't need them right now. But they'd say, how about we send them to you, put them in your vault. If we need them back, we'll pay to have them shipped back. And in the meantime, you have them there if you need them. Won't charge you anything for them until you use them. Great, I said. So now, Kai, we're buying product 4, 6, 8 weeks in advance, running logistics, hedging it, and watching it, you know, from the time that it leaves the mint in Austria or Australia or the UK, watching it as it goes across the Atlantic, watching it as it gets through customs, running logistics to get it on a Brinks truck and get it across the country, receiving it, checking it in. And before it's even fully checked in, most of it has been pre-sold. This is what it's like nowadays. And that's, you know, when you talk about a just-in-time type of supply chain world we live in, well, precious metals are not immune to that. So I guess in a nutshell, I think it will be the defining characteristic of this market. It's already getting very, very tough. And if we look at what's happening on the COMEX market and the LME, the London Metals Exchange, I think from the top down, it portrays much more difficulty getting product, because what we are seeing both on the LME and the COMEX are record withdrawals to the point where silver is being bled off of the exchanges at record levels. And, you know, right now there's only, last I checked, somewhere in the neighborhood of 55 million ounces, I think was the number last I saw, in the registered category for silver. And, you know, we've delivered twice that amount just off the ETFs. The authorized participants have backdoored over 100 million ounces in the last 4 months. So you're seeing the lowest amount of silver on the LME, the London Metals Exchange, since they started keeping records. Massive drawdowns on the COMEX, huge drawdowns out the back door of the ETFs by the authorized participants. So you're seeing a bleeding away of physical metal off of the exchanges, where these are the exchanges that provide the 1,000-ounce bars to the mints to make the coins. So it's kind of a trickle-down thing where I think ultimately the mints are going to have a harder time getting silver, kind of like the U.S. mint does right now. And that ultimately is going to feed into what I believe will be a market defined by a very difficult time sourcing product easily and affordably.
Very interesting comments there as well. Like, I'm looking at it, and I'm one of the first questions that came to mind is like, who are you mainly competing with, right? Like, who's absorbing all the gold and silver right now in the market space? Obviously, there are other bullion dealers, but is there one big buyer out there? Are there several bigger buyers out there behind anonymous names or so? Is there something you see in the background? And I'm hinting at central banks here, but do you see any of that happening?
Yeah, well, the central banks and the commercial banks are draining it. In fact, right now, last I looked on COMEX, I believe there was somewhere, like I said, 55 million ounces. And the open interest right now on COMEX is, last I looked, was 1,500% higher than the number of bars in the registered category. So, you know, if you look at what's happening in terms of gold and you said, who's doing it? You know, one of the things that was unusual, Kai, was in 2020, we saw a new group of reportables off the Commitment of Traders report. And so every week, the COMEX market publishes a report that shows the positioning of the largest traders on the exchange. And my entire career, there were two traders. There was the commercials and the specs, as they're called, which are the hedge funds. And there are lots of traders on COMEX, but the biggest ones, the biggest positions are portrayed on the Commitment of Traders report. And it was always just two groups, commercials, JP City, Goldman, Bank of America, hedge funds called the specs. And as one would go long, the other would go short. And then in 2020, we see this this new group of traders called the others that they call the other group, they're called others on the reportables. The Commitment of Traders is reporting them, calling them others. And these are supposedly sovereign wealth funds and family offices. So if you look at what happened about just about a month ago, we saw in one day, 41% of all the gold kilo bars. Now that's an important thing here, and I'll explain in a minute. 41% of all the gold kilo bars taken off of the COMEX. Now, typically the sovereign mints or the sovereign entities like the central banks, they don't buy the kilos. They buy good delivery bars, either 100 or 400 ounce, 400 off of LME, the London Metal Exchange, 100 off of COMEX. I don't even really know why the COMEX holds kilos. Maybe they're mini contracts or whatnot. But so the reason I believe it was the others or the sovereign wealth funds and the family offices who did this is because you don't see the central banks doing this. In one day, 41% of all of those kilo bars or 100 and just under 175 million ounces was withdrawn off the COMEX market in one day. Who the hell's got enough money to take 175 million ounces of gold off in one day? So who is doing this? The most well-funded, well-informed, influential traders on the globe. And, you know, I would argue these people are tied into the people pulling the strings at the highest level. So we have seen literally, if you go back to 2017, Kai, we have seen a progression of accumulation and more importantly and more interestingly, a removal of counterparty risk. As in 2017, we saw, starting with the German Bundesbank, the Bank of Hungary, the Bank of Poland, the Bank of Turkey, the Dutch National Bank, the Bank of Austria, the Czech National Bank. We have seen a progression of withdrawal off of the exchanges. Now, in their case, it was off of the Bank of England and the New York Fed. It was repatriating gold that has been held by the exchanges, these exchanges for years, in some cases, decades. It was very unusual to see that. And then these same banks that were repatriating their gold have gone on a buying spree for quite some time. That was front-running the 2019 reclassification of gold as a tier one reserve asset and the only other one in the world. And since that moment, we have seen a continuation, a common theme of accumulation and most interestingly, taking possession. Pulling it off of the exchanges in an effort to remove counterparty risk. So this is nothing new, and it's something that is continuing to this day. So whether you look at it starting at the top with the commercial banks who started the central banks who started the trend, JP Morgan, who by Ted Butler's estimation, even though pleading guilty to manipulating the metals market to the Justice Department and paying a $920 million fine, watching Michael Nowak and two other traders, he being their head gold trader, off their metals desk in New York City, now found guilty for doing the exact same thing and going to prison, hasn't been sentenced yet. Whether it be the commercial banks like JP Morgan, even in that environment, who amassed, according to Butler, 1.1 billion ounces of silver and 45 million ounces of gold, the largest physical position the world has ever seen, or the other commercial banks. So the central banks, the commercial banks, the others, let's call them the sovereign wealth funds and the family offices, or the authorized participants, which are hedge funds and again, commercial banks draining the ETFs, entities draining the London Metal Exchange, who the hell is doing it? And it's a common thread that we are seeing. So the biggest money in the world is front running what's coming. The biggest money in the world is always closest to the information spigot. So yeah, they have more money and yeah, they are more influential, but you know, imagine you're a central banker and you went to high school, you and I went to high school together, you know, and we're best friends. You might call me and say, you know, the hedge fund you're running, well, if I were running that hedge fund, maybe I would take possession of 175 million ounces of gold, just saying, if you look at the positioning of the commercial banks as well on the exchanges, they are for the first time. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at the commercials, Kai, the commercials aren't just on the commitment of traders report. It's not just the banks. It's also they lump the producers into the commercial category. So the producers or anyone who hedges their metal for their business is considered a commercial. And I don't buy that so much because typically the producers in a company like mine that would be lumped into that category because we're hedging it specifically to protect our business. We're not hedging to speculate. Now, most of us are hedging to offset risk, but the commercial banks hedge to speculate mostly. And so anyways, if you just pull out the producers and look at the position just of the banks, they're really long. I've never seen them this long ever in my whole career. So you have the most sophisticated, well-funded, well-informed traders on the globe who are not only systematically draining the exchanges of metal, taking possession of it, but also in paper going long, and they have hoodwinked through a tremendous amount of manipulation, the managed money, the hedge funds, into going short. And the hedge funds always lose the war. They may win a battle or two, but to see the hedge funds record short on COMEX is a position that I would not want to be in if I were them. And I think they don't have the pain tolerance or the deep pockets that the commercial banks do. And as prices start to rise, you will see short covering enact what I believe is a religious experience to some of these traders. So it's a trickle-down theory starting at the top, and the biggest money in the world is always out in front of price, of information, and of positioning into whatever it is that's coming next. And I think so. This is a long game. You got to be patient. But if we were playing chess and I looked at the board, I'd say, shit, Kai, this is a board that looks like someone's about ready to call check. We're not there yet. But it's as a cause for as much optimism in rising prices as I've seen maybe in my entire career.
Yeah, definitely an exciting environment we're in right now. Fed meeting actually happening today as we're recording this. FOMC notes or announcement should happen in the next 2 hours here. But I was thinking, like, how much does the Fed have a grip on the silver price? That's one thing. But also maybe, and you hinted at it, sort of what's to come next? Right. And I like asking that question because I often hear hashtag end the Fed or the monetary system is collapsing. I'm always curious to hear and your thoughts as well. Like what is next? Are we going back to a gold and silver standard?
I think the Federal Reserve is. I mean, I think they're full of crap. Let's just call it what it is. I don't think they have any intention on really getting tough on inflation. So let's define a few things. First of all, we define inflation as measured by the CPI right now at 8.5%, but the CPI is complete and total nonsense because it strips out food, energy, and housing. The CPI used to be calculated prior to 1980 in a manner that was a more accurate reflection of inflation. And there's a man named John Williams of shadowstats.com that all he really does is show us the way they used to calculate numbers and what they would be now. Now, in July of this year, the National Bureau of Economic Research, a NBER, a four-letter acronym, they're just another Washington-based think tank. Now, they came out and they said the 16.5% inflation peak, or not peak, number in June or July of 1980, if measured by today's standards, would have been 9.1%. And I think they published that in July specifically to say that the 9.1% inflation that we had in July, if measured the way it used to be, would have at least been 16.5%. Right now, the the numbers that John Williams comes out with is north of 18%. So let's just first and foremost call inflation a scam, not only because it the measurements, it behooves the government to understate inflation. And I think, you know, I mean, the easiest explanation of that is that the ideal of every nation is obviously to be able to print as much paper as it wants, but at the same time, keeping inflation in check. And the question is, how the hell do you do that? And the best way you do that is to lie about the inflation rate, which is exactly what all nations are doing, in particular the Fed. So, okay, so we have 8.5% inflation right now. We know that's probably 17 or 18%. But even if we believe that nonsense, Volcker says, Powell says he's getting tough on inflation, right? Tough on inflation has been to raise the federal funds rate to 2.25%. That's pussyfooting. That's jawboning. That is not getting tough at all on inflation. If we go back to 1980 and we see what Paul Volcker did with 16 or 17% inflation, Paul Volcker blew up the economy. Paul Volcker blew up inflation. Paul Volcker was the last politician we've ever had with balls and enough conviction to do something that was politically suicidal in the respect that he raised interest rates on the federal funds rate to 19.75%. That's getting tough on inflation. That is not pussyfooting. That is blowing up inflation at the expense of the economy. But in 1980, we had a surplus. We were not the largest debtor nation on the planet Earth. And when you realize that we have a national debt of north of $30 trillion in unfunded liabilities on our balance sheet as commitments, north of $100 trillion in things like the $55 trillion IOUs in Social Security or Medicare, Medicaid, and government military pensions, all total exceed another $100 trillion, $130 to $40 trillion in funded and unfunded liabilities, most of which was accumulated at the lowest interest rates in human history. Raising rates is a real big problem at that rate. And just when you speak of the government's obligation on the funded liabilities, every 1% interest rate increase today represents $300 billion in interest payments to our creditors. And Volcker, or I keep saying Volcker, Powell talking about raising rates today, later today, by anywhere from 75 basis points to 1%. So you're talking 270 to 300 billion in interest payment increases just in that move alone. But is that getting tough on inflation? Hell no, it's not. Because you have inflation at, let's call it 9%, and the federal funds rate, even if they move it up to 3% or 3.25%, on a 10-year treasury note or a 10-year treasury bond, if you're getting 3.5%, which you're not, but let's just say you are, and you have inflation at 8.5%, which is higher, but let's just call it that, that's a negative 5% return, a real return of negative 5%. And so when you talk about gold and silver not paying any interest, it sure beats the hell out of negative 5%. And in real terms, if you really call what inflation is, try negative 15%. And so it's a situation where the numbers on inflation and the Fed are it's a lie. And I think there are forces at work that if you feel like going down the rabbit hole, I'll take you, that will maybe even enact the Great Reset. And it's not the Fed, because I truly do believe Powell and the rest of his cronies and Janet Yellen and all these idiots who have screwed the pooch by creating more money in the last 3 years than the entire history of the country preceding it. More money in the last 3 years than in the entire history of the United States preceding it. And what is inflation? It is always an increase in the money supply, period. It's not Putin, it's nothing else. It's an increase in the money supply. And if you really want to add a little kicker to it, you decrease productivity. Well, what does it sound like we have done for the last 3 years? We've cranked up the money supply, we've kept interest rates suppressed, and we've paid people to sit on their couch eating cookies and playing video games, not producing stuff. More money chasing less stuff. Fewer people producing stuff, less stuff to be sold, and more money chasing it. There's your inflation. So, you know, getting tough on inflation is not what they're doing. If they wanted to get tough on inflation, today's federal funds rate would not be risen to 3 or 3.25%. That's complete and total crap. It would be raised the federal funds rate to 10%. Now you got Paul Volcker balls, and now you're doing what it takes to stop inflation. But what does that do to the asset prices? If you have 10% federal funds rate, you have 15, 16, 17% 30-year mortgage. You know, we saw just from raising the federal funds rate from 1 to 2.25% or 1.5 to 2.25%, the 30-year mortgage doubled from 3 to almost 7%, over doubled. What happens if it's at 10? Right now you killed inflation, but what did you do to the housing market with 30-year mortgages at 18%, 17%, 16%, whatever it is? How about the bond market, where the majority of all the bonds that were issued over the last 3 years have been at 0 or 1%? What happens to those? What happens to the debt obligation on variable rate debt? What happens to the companies all throughout, you know, the Dow and the Russell 5000 who have expanded their corporations and hired people and done all of these things based upon low interest rates and easy money? You collapse everything. Stocks, bonds, and real estate are all inversely correlated to a rise in rates and are all or have been at all-time highs. And this is the problem. It's either death by hyperinflation or death by the greatest depression. This is what is keeping Powell up at night. This is why he has become the greatest pussyfooter of all time, because he's trying to tell us that Paul Volcker was his hero and he's getting tough on inflation, and yet his actions are ridiculously lame, to say the least. So I think you ain't seen nothing yet, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, no, interesting. Like, I'm really, as I said, I'm really curious to see how this is playing out, right? And the U.S. dollar is extremely strong right now, a bit to my surprise, honestly. But do you see cracks in the system already? Or, like, are you going to continue this? Like, and I'm just thinking of Japan. It's not really comparable, but their debt-to-GDP ratio is 240-250%. We're only at 130% in the U.S. Do you see cracks in the system, or are we just going to continue as is because nobody's going to call the debt?
I see a massive crack, and it's one that I've been the only one talking about for 2 years. And now you're beginning to see more people talk about it. And I've seen it clear as day. And I think if you really take a step back and realize that if they were really getting tough on inflation, then we would see rates rising 2, 3, 4, 5, 6% each meeting, not 75 basis points or 1% or preceding this 50 basis points. That's not getting tough. I think the real crack is what is happening around the globe. And, you know, I started noticing this trend, as I mentioned, in 2019. Actually, I started noticing in 2017 when all the central banks said, give us back our gold. In 2018, those same banks bought more gold as a group than they did in the 60 years previously combined. In 2019, the Bank of International Settlements, which is the most influential bank on the planet, the central bank or central bank, reclassified gold as the world's only other tier one reserve asset. That's a big deal. There's only one other tier one reserve asset. It's U.S. dollars and treasuries. Almost for 80 years, it's been that way. And out of nowhere, after the banks go on a repatriation and buying spree, obviously they were clued into what's coming, they reclassified gold as a tier one asset. In 2020, we see a continuation of all of the central banks accumulating gold, but then we really see the rise of the Belt Road Initiative. Are you familiar with that by chance, Kai?
Yeah, well, the Belt Road is China connecting to Europe more or less through all the countries, but financing all the countries along the way and sort of making them dependent on the UN, right?
Right. So, well, kind of. The Belt Road Initiative is the largest infrastructure project in human history. And it is connecting, as you mentioned, not just Asia and Europe, but also Africa. It is industrializing Asia, Africa, parts of Europe, and it's all also going all the way across to South America. And it is the most ambitious infrastructure project in human history. The representation of the Belt Road just as is represents north of 75% of human population, 45% of global GDP. I'll make a few points about the Belt Road Initiative. Every OPEC country, all of them, all 13 of them, are members of the Belt Road Initiative. The Belt Road Initiative, the majority, if not all of the contracts on this massive infrastructure project, which, by the way, will be, you know, roads and railways and maritime channels and the whole nine yards, it will only be patrolled by military and commerce. It is the Panama Canal on steroids, but the majority, if not all of the contracts, are settling in the new Chinese digital yuan. That's a big deal for where I'm going to take you. But the digital yuan has now, let's call it a beta test, a 3-year successful test, all already worked at the Winter Olympics, and all of the the contracts on the Belt Road, it's successfully showing that a Chinese distributed ledger technology, digital central bank currency, works. And with close to 20 billion in successful trades, let's call it a beta test for where I'm going to take you, it works. So let's talk about how Klaus Schwab and his great reset and all of this craziness happens, because it's not at the hands of the Fed. And I think that's the most important thing, or they would have done something about it already. They would have quantitatively tightened in a meaningful way, not pussyfooting. They would have raised rates meaningfully, not pussyfooting. But if you look at what's happening, this coalition, so you have the Belt Road Initiative, which all the OPEC members are part of. And then you have the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa. But you have other countries now joining the BRICS nations. You have Egypt, you have Iran, you have Venezuela, you have Argentina. You have all of these countries joining the BRICS nations. You put all of them together, it represents close to 90% of human population. Now, how does it get really funky? Saudi Arabia just announced their intention to join the BRICS nation. They are already part of the Belt Road Initiative. What makes the dollar the world reserve currency? I ask people this, and it's shocking that most people don't know, but it is the protection of the Saudi kingdom. And by extension, OPEC's promise to sell oil globally in US dollars. In 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window and went back on our promise to the world of governments being able to redeem their dollars for gold at a fixed rate of $35 an ounce, our dollar became fiat. It was 3 years later that Henry Kissinger was dispatched to the Saudi kingdom and said, hey, we got your back. We're going to protect you. No one's ever going to screw with you ever, ever. Before that, OPEC is going to denominate oil globally in dollars. And it's been for 50 years that this synthetic demand for the dollar has been created. Every country on the planet has to own them in order to buy oil, period. And that's been the way that it has been because of this relationship. Well, the day we left Afghanistan with people hanging from the wings of a transport plane, with our own American men and women behind enemy lines, with the people who the Afghani freedom fighters who trusted us screwed behind enemy lines with their biometrics given to the Taliban as we left, not to mention the billions of dollars worth of military equipment we left there. We ruined our image in many respects globally. It was an embarrassing day to be an American, even for a patriot like myself. And there's no coincidence to the announcement, the timing of the announcement, the day after Russia and Saudi Arabia announced a joint military cooperation agreement. Think about that for a second. We've been protecting them for 50 years. And now Russia says, well, we're going to do it too. The next day, Nigeria did the same thing. So you're seeing a joint military cooperation agreement between Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Nigeria. Nigeria, part of the Belt Road Initiative. Saudi Arabia, part of the Belt Road Initiative. Oh, well, that sounds to me like they're being protected by China too. Russia being kicked out of the SWIFT system and weaponizing the dollar as the world reserve currency might have been the dumbest thing we could have ever done. We pushed them right into the arms of the Chinese and their CIPS system, the cross interbank payment system, which mirrors SWIFT. You have, because of this rallying cry of Western hegemony and hypocrisy, that rallying cry is, are we next? Are you next, Saudi Arabia? Are you next, China, who's got your eyes set on Taiwan? How does the weaponizing of the dollar serve our purposes when 85% of the world is still trading with Russia? It doesn't. All it has done is piss everyone off and make everyone think those bastards are going to come after us next. So let's coalesce. And what you are seeing is the coalition of 90% of human population into the BRICS nations and on the Belt Road Initiative. And here's what it takes. The system, Kai, is this fragile. You want to talk about the shit hitting the fan and everything blowing up? It happens like this. And how? Saudi Arabia and OPEC stands on a stage on a Sunday night in China, a Monday morning here, arm in arm, and they say, listen, to the West. And by the way, you know, the euro, which is a basket case, they're no better off. They're going to realize how dangerous it is to screw with Russia in December this year when they're freezing to death. But if you're any of these nations, why would you ever trust the European Union or the United States, who have proven to sanction? And in everyone else's minds, we're hypocritical. Look at what we did in Syria. Look at what we did in Iraq. Look at what we did in Libya. We are hypocritical in the world's eyes. Okay, maybe even if you take a step back and speak honestly, we are hypocritical. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So, you know, was it about securing a position next to Iran and securing oil and taking their gold? I don't know. But the point of it is we're hypocritical. So as fragile of a system it is, they say, hey, West, thank you, thank you, thank you for the memories. Thank you for having our back for the last 50 years. It's been a real joy. But I'll tell you what, we are joining the BRICS nations with our brothers and sisters and 90% of the world's population. We've decided through OPEC that now that we're being protected by Russia and China and India and all of the other countries in the BRICS nations, that we're going to start to issue oil and other currencies, not just US dollars. Remember, every OPEC country is on the Belt Road. In the BRICS, six of the 13 OPEC countries are already on the BRICS or have applied. The seventh, United Arab Emirates, just joined the BRICS banks, which means there's five other countries there, or six other countries that I'm sure will join BRICS, but they're already on the Belt Road. And all they need to say is, hey, thanks. We're going to now open up oil purchases in yuan, in ruble, in rupee, in gold, in euro, and dollars. How about that? And when that happens, bang, every country on the planet that's had to own dollars for the past 50 years will have that moment, just like in Trading Places when one Duke brother says to the other, sell, Mortimer, sell, because every country will dump dollars. And when every country starts to dump dollars because they no longer need to own it, and everyone else is dumping dollars, rendering their holdings worth less and less and less, where do those dollars go? Here, back home. What is the byproduct of hyperinflation, as there is way more money offshore than there is here, and all those dollars hitting in a matter of hours, interest rates spike to the moon. Now, my question to you is, were our leaders that stupid, or was this an intended consequence? Did they realize that $130 trillion of debt, most of it accumulated the lowest interest rates in human history, could never be paid back? And it's better to find a villain because they're not doing anything about it. We're getting tough on inflation. We're raising rates by 50 basis points. Bull crap you are. In fact, what you're doing is jawboning and pussyfooting. But if Putin and Xi and the BRICS and OPEC do this, as it looks like they are, every day there is another story. The BRICS just came out and said, we're issuing a new world reserve currency and it's going to be pegged to a basket of commodities. Really, every single country on the BRICS nations, the RICS and BRICS, Russia, China, India, South Africa, or all of the other countries, are the largest accumulators and producers of commodities in the world. So all these countries, think of the Chinese digital yuan, a beta test. What better way to roll out a new distributed ledger technology than to show the pegging, the immutability of the pegging of all of these countries pegging commodities, gold, silver, oil, grain, sugar, whatever it is, everyone not only is coalescing against the rallying cry of hypocrisy and of sanctions and all of these things that the West are doing, but that's not enough. You need to do it the right way. And everyone needs to have the seat at the table based upon what they've pledged and the immutability of it and the veracity. Don't believe me, look at the distributed ledger. There it is. And bang, just like that, the dollars dump, interest rates spike in the United States. There's your villain. Wasn't us, the Fed, who screwed the pooch. It's them. And interest rates spike to a level that the Fed does not have the cojones to do. And when that happens, stocks, bonds, and real estate at all-time highs inversely correlated to a rise in rates all collapse. There's your Klaus Schwab moment. In the matter of 1 second, dollar, stocks, bonds, and real estate all collapse and bring everyone down to a common denominator. There's your great reset. There is your massive problem. And when that happens, if you're not already positioned in precious metals, well, good luck to you, because you're long going to be screwed completely and totally. And I think that is where the crack is. That is what people need to focus on. The sideshow, that's the Fed. They're not going to do anything meaningful. The rest of the world, 90% of human population, that's what we all need to be focusing on.
Oh, fantastic commentary, Andy. Really, really appreciate you sharing your insights with us. Really insightful. And I think that is a crack. I'm just curious, and we don't have to go into this now, like, will it happen over time, or is there going to be one event and all of a sudden we're going to switch? I feel like there's going to be one trigger that's going to cause that crack to open wide, in my opinion. So,
well, you could argue that the what expedited this process was kicking Russia out of SWIFT and weaponizing the dollar. I think what that moment will be is when they all come and tell us what the digital currency or their new currency is. They just came out and said that about a month ago. You can Google BRICS to issue world reserve currency. And just the other day, let me find it here on my computer. There was an article that came out, a man named Sergei Glazyev. Let me just find it real quick. Bear with me one second. I'll read it to you. It's quite interesting. So Sergei Glazyev is the Russian minister in charge of integration and macroeconomics of the Eurasian Economic Union. He says, the article says, Glazyev laid out the fundamental principles upon which the new post-US dollar economic system will be based. Although some common unit will be agreed upon, it will not be based upon any particular currency, as with the Bretton Woods order, that means the dollar, but rather a market basket of local currencies, those are the BRICS currencies, tied more deeply to an array of real commodities such as gold and other precious metals, grain, hydrocarbons, sugar, et cetera. So this is the head guy that's in charge of doing this, who's come out and said this is what's going to happen. But about 3 weeks before that, right after Saudi Arabia said they're going to join BRICS, the BRICS nation said we're issuing a new global reserve currency. Hasn't come out yet, but my guess is they will use the success of the three-year beta test of the Chinese digital yuan as the rails for the new BRICS currency, to show the immutability of what is being pledged to the system. So, you know, when you look at a concept like the European Union, you know, it didn't work because the countries were all moving in different directions. Some were the engines of growth and others weren't. Some took long vacations over the summer, some didn't. Some were more productive and others were more more of a welfare state. Didn't work. Here, everyone who's joining has a mutual distrust and borderline hatred of the West. And they've been under the West's thumb for centuries. And now they're getting their seat at the table. So there's your rallying cry. But to do it the right way, it goes beyond mutual hatred and distrust. That certainly will coalesce and make everyone, yeah, let's do it. But you all have to have an equal footing at the table. And the way that you do that, when you look at the UN, you know, the US dominates the UN. That's not fair. Everyone should have an equal footing at the table. And you do that by pledging an equal amount of a commodity to a distributed ledger and leaving it there for the whole world to see, even if it's a private blockchain and not an open source blockchain, as it most certainly will be a private invitation type of blockchain system. They'll make it so that the world can see what's pledged there and the immutability of it on the technology. And I think that is what spells the end, the death knell, if you will, of the Western system. And not only that, when you just simply talk about the fallacy of composition, Kai, which means the individual parts are not as significant as they are all together, whether it be economically or militarily, each and every one of those countries would not want to go to war economically or militarily with the US, not even China. It wouldn't do them any good. But put them all together and it is one hell of an adversary, where you have all of these countries together, which represent 90% of human population. And now you're even seeing Mexico wanting to join the BRICS, Turkey wanting to join the BRICS, Egypt wanting to join the BRICS. These are countries that are our allies. They're joining the BRICS. They're leaving the Western system. All of these countries in Europe, Hungary, Turkey, Poland, Czech Republic, a lot of the European Union countries that are in the union but don't trade the euro, trade their own currency, they're the largest accumulators of gold right now. Why? Because they know you're going to need that to have a seat at the table. Turkey, for the first 7 months of 2022, has bought more gold than any central bank on the planet. Turkey. Why? They're getting out of the system and they're moving to the BRICS. Why not? That's what everybody's going to do. And who's going to be left? The West, the US, Japan, the Western European Union, and Canada. They're all broken and solvent, every single one of them. And all of the other countries that will be joining will be resource rich, And they will, they're all the countries that produce the commodities. And if not, they've gone on a buying spree since 2017, every one of them. They're positioning. This is a game of chess. People in this country think in terms of seconds and minutes. They're more concerned about the Johnny Depp trial or O.J. Simpson or any of these things that are relevant, while as someone, a country like China thinks in terms of decades and has been positioning and waiting for this moment and setting up infrastructure internally with their ghost cities and all of this infrastructure, and externally. And they've been doing that with the proceeds of us buying all of their party favors for the last 20 or 30 years. And now they have risen to a level of prominence, and they are using that influence and that wealth to industrialize the world, whether it be South America or Africa. And all of these countries are moving to this coalition, and the West is on the sidelines. So I think that's what people need to pay attention to, not what the Fed will or won't do. That's just a bunch of nonsense.
No, absolutely. I fully agree with you, Andy, but we have to cut it off here at this time. Next episode, we're going to dive into why the silver premiums are so high and also why silver trading below $20 and gold below $17 or even $2,000, if all of this is in fact true. And, well, it's pointing that way, but why aren't the prices reacting? But that's a discussion for another day, because that will take us down a whole nother rabbit hole. And Andy, I really appreciate it for your time. Really, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure you'll be busy. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm sure I will too. And I'll look forward to coming back on again, Kai, and we can talk all about the silver premiums. As being a U.S. Mint distributor, one of only 27 in the world, I'm very, very keenly aware of high silver premiums, especially in the Eagles. And that would definitely be a topic for our next discussion. And I'll look very forward to it. Awesome. Let me know when I can come back and I'll be here.
We'll get that set up as soon as possible. Awesome. Andy, thank you so much. And to everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. This was an episode of SEV Live. I'm Kai Hoffman, the CEO of the SOAR Financial Group and the JR Mining Guy on Twitter. Leave a comment, leave a like, subscribe to the channel. 80% over 80% of you are not subscribed to the channel who are watching. So make sure to change that. Really appreciate it. And let us know what you think. Thank you so much. And we'll be back with more soon.